Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Edwige Danticat, whose latest novel is Claire of the Sea Light, also the author of The Dewbreakers, The Farming of Bones. There are four novels. This is the fifth novel. There are three works of nonfiction, including Brother, I'm Dying, which I spoke to you about a few years back, and four books for young readers. And according to IMDb, you've also been an actress, which we'll talk about briefly, and an editor, and you've worked on documentaries as well. This novel, from what I can tell, seems to have come about from a story in a collection called Haiti Noir. Were you the editor of that?
Yes, I was the editor of Haiti Noir, and actually soon we have Haiti Noir 2, the classics, coming out. And it's an anthology about Haitian writing, contemporary and older writing. So I edited it and I had a story in it, and it was the beginning of this book.
Did you know at the time that it would be a book, or did that come afterward?
That came afterwards. I just was enamored with the story of this little girl, and I started writing the story, and then it just grew. There were things that they referenced in the story about the town and other people, and I thought, oh, I want to find out more about these people. And so I started writing these little bits about all the different characters that are mentioned, and they extended into this web of people throughout this entire little town.
The town itself, Villa Rose, you use that in another novel called Crickrack?
Yes, actually, Crickrack is my short story collection. It's my second book. It was published in 1995, and I decided to invent a town for Crickrack because in Breath Eyes Memory, my first book, I had some real places, and people who were from those places always kept coming up to me and saying, you know, that's not how the town square is, and so forth. And so I thought, I'll be like Faulkner and all these other people who have their own little place, their postage stamp of a town. So I decided to invent my own little postage stamp of a town called Ville Rose.
Were any of the characters from Claire appear in any of the other stories or no?
They didn't, but actually when I started writing Claire, I went back and reread Crickrack. It's very hard for writers, I think, to reread their early work because I wanted to be consistent about my portrayal of the town. And in writing this book, actually, the town grew in my own mind. It developed a history, developed some anecdotes, and I really had to, you know, I sort of created a map for myself. But now I imagined, you know, at some point, probably in the future, people reading them together and seeing, you know, is this the same town? For example, in Crickrack, there's a story called Seeing Things Simply, which I think we see most of the town in, where there's a woman who's an artist who rents a house there, and there's a little girl from the town who poses for her and helps her around the house and things like that. So that's probably that story that most, where we most see the town. But this book shows a whole other view of it. And I think also it brings it up to the present, because Crickrack was in the 90s. There were no cell phones then and things like that. And then now the town is rather different.
When I was looking at a review in Washington Post, it said this book takes place in 2009. And I don't recall anything saying specifically 2009. Am I missing something? Did I miss something?
Well, you're missing the galley, because what happens is in the galley we had the year. And then I thought, why not just take out the year and let it be any year? Because to some extent, I felt, you know, after years of working on the book, I felt, oh, this book then, if it's 2009, it's going to be defined by 2010, which is in the year that the big earthquake happened in Haiti. So the galley had the year, and then the printed book doesn't.
It also did something else as I was reading that and thinking that 2009 is that even though there's no magic in the book, because of all the coincidences and connections, there is a feeling of magic realism. And once you put a date on it, that goes right out the window.
Exactly. And I thought, you lose also this kind of timelessness, right, that it could happen at any time. And it's interesting that you bring up the point of magic realism, because I always think of it as more realistic magic, the great possibilities of so many things that are able to happen. But sometimes things that happen really in nature, for example, in the book, there's a disappearance of all the frogs in the town, which is something, you know, if you think about here in the U.S., where people always talk about the disappearance of the bees and these things that if you put them in a kind of setting, people would think as magic realism, but are really things like nature in a way is magical, you know, if we stop and think about it. And so I felt like pinning it down would mean like, oh, this can't happen now and things like that. So ultimately, I felt like it was a last-minute call, but a good call to take out the date.
Before we get into discussing some of the characters themselves, one more question about the book itself. You know, you've said in interviews that it kind of grew out from that story and kept growing. And yet I noticed that throughout the book, there's mentions of, you know, I hate to call it a gun in a handbag, but we can call it that. There are tons of guns and handbags that you may or may not come back to, and you come back to all of them. So at what point did it come together? Did you know what you were doing, or did you just go, oh, that's why that happened?
I love that, the gun in a handbag. It's like the gun in the cupboard. One of the great things about this sort of structure, and I think, and I know that it's a structure that's annoying for some people where you're just going, you're going back and forth between the characters. But for me, one of the great things about working with that is that you had these guns, you had several guns, and this must have been a very heavy handbag. I wasn't always sure where things were going. There were elements of surprise for me too, as the writer. So, I mean, I think one of the great things about being a writer is that you have a front row seat into a story and you find out what happens first, and there's that level of excitement when things connect. So I didn't always know where things were going, but I was just always very excited when these connections were made, because ultimately, you know, the book is set in a single night and with recollections and so forth. And I always imagine the reader, and even me, the writer, as someone who wonders on the beach that night, that where the book's main action takes place in that one evening. And you wander in like a visitor in the town, and the reader does, and you are hearing these snippets of conversation, and you're putting together your own portraits of these different people, and you're pointing and thinking, oh, this is that's what connects the mayor to the school teacher, and that's what connects, you know, the radio hostess to this person who's just returned. I love reading in a way that helps me participate. I love to feel like when I'm reading a book, I'm sort of not outside the book, and that's really one of the things that I was attempting to do with all these guns, if you will.
The book starts out seemingly like a collection of disparate short stories, but as it unfolds into itself, we learn certain things. So early on, there's a murder, and then we learn how that happened and who that affected and what that led to, which led to something else, which led to something else. Was the book written in the order in which we're reading it?
No, it was written in a very different order, because choice of the structure came about in trying to visit different households in this town and really the ripple effect of certain actions. And so something would happen and then I would write then another part to find out. But I think of the book as a kind of hybrid form between a novel and short stories, which there are many precedents for, you know, from Winesburg, Ohio, the Sherwood Anderson's book, to Gene Toomer's Cain and other books like that. So I think of it as this kind of hybrid in between, in which there's more space really to contort things and play with all these elements of plot and character.
Edwidge Dantica, there's also a radio station, and in one interview you said that you almost conceived this to be a radio show, radio serial to be told in different episodes. Is that right?
Yeah, I think one day I will still write that book, because initially when I was thinking of writing this book, I thought, I'm going to write a novel that is a radio show, and every chapter of the novel will be an episode of that show. And there's still a radio show in this book, a show called Dis-moi, which is hosted by a woman named Louise George. And I'm just extraordinarily fascinated by the radio. I've always been, because I grew up in an area of Haiti called Bel Air, where even if you didn't have a radio in your own house, you were always listening to somebody's radio, because people had the radio on as a way of entertainment, you know, just getting information, as opposed to TV, because you don't, you know, electricity is not a given. But the radio you can, you know, do with batteries and other ways. So the radio was a huge part of my childhood. And then later on, I was friends with radio journalists and would have an opportunity to go into radio stations in Haiti and see the other side of that. So I was always intrigued and wanted to write about the radio. So Louise George, who's the radio hostess in the book, takes the opportunity to use the radio as a kind of justice. So you mentioned this murder, and everybody in the town, as many murders have been in Haiti, even high-profile murders, everybody in the town knows this murder will not be solved. There will be no trial. There will be no justice. And so Louise George, who's the radio hostess, gives herself the task of airing dirty laundry, but also it's a gossip show, but she also perceives like the high end of it as being a show that offers people an opportunity to get justice. And so people who were victimized are invited to come on her show and talk about what happened to them, and then these crimes are exposed, which become then the only way that they get justice.
Are there small radio stations like that with programs like that in Haiti?
There are quite a few. I mean, there are a lot of programs that are political programs where people talk about the news of the day. But there are also these other, like, especially when you go outside of Port-au-Prince, there are sometimes these regional programs that have religious content, that have sort of, it's like the love program. Or people, and then there's the advice programs where people call in and ask for advice. I mean, there's a whole range of programs.
Are they in English, Creole, French?
They're mostly in Creole, because Creole is the language that everybody speaks in Haiti. There are some that are in French. Some of the sort of the news delivery programs tend to be in French, some of them, but mostly they're in Creole.
And Creole itself is kind of a...
It's a language on its own, with its own grammar, with its own orthography, but it's a language that did derive out of, say, I mean, so the basic moment of, I guess, its emergence would be when you had the European colonists, you know, the French and the Spanish, you know, facing the Africans that they had kidnapped and brought to our part of the world, and then they had to communicate somehow. And so a language that emerged out of that. So it has also the influence of the Tainos that had just been decimated. Some of the words still remain in the language. And now, you know, you have also an infusion, the influence of English from the British, who had a mild colonial stay on our shores, but also the constant infusion of also people who are like me, people who are diaspora, who live abroad. Now there's poetry in Creole and literature in Creole, certainly songs. Of course, 100% of the people speak Creole.
I noticed that in many places, these kinds of languages, like, for instance, Pidgin in Hawaii, are dying out. Is that happening to Creole, or is that still the predominant language then?
I would venture to say that I think, rather than dying out, Creole is becoming stronger. There's just recently a professor at MIT, Michel Desgraves, who he's Haitian, who got a grant to help produce more material in Creole, scientific material. And there's been more of a push, because Haiti is a place, it's one of the few places where, say, most children, when they go to school, then start out in a foreign language, because there are kids who don't speak French at home. Like, I didn't speak French at home, but suddenly you go to school when you're 3 or 4, and everything is in French. And so there's been, in recent years, more and more of a push to actually integrate more Creole in the school system and to develop materials, teaching materials in Creole, because that's often what people are saying, well, we don't have the materials. So I think rather in the case of Haitian Creole, rather than dying out, I think it's at a point where it might be flourishing.
If I were to ask you a question in English and you responded in Creole, let's suppose I were to ask you about the origins of the characters Max Sr. and Max Jr. Give me their origins and say it in Creole.
Max Sr. avec Max Jr. c'est... Bon, Max Sr. c'est papa, Max Sr. c'est petit. Donc, m'te vle écrire un bagay relation papa petit qui pas d'accord. Donc, yo te c'était deux personnages que m'te vle, ouais, qui j'en l'ont papa toléré crime que petite li fait. I wanted to write a father-son relationship in which the son had committed a terrible act and the father was wrestling with that as a sort of a father who sees himself as a reformer, as someone who is personally imperfect but wants to make a difference in his community, and then his son is wrestling with his own issues. But in the middle of their relationship is a woman named Floor who works for Max Sr. and then becomes pregnant with Max Jr.'s son. So their relationship pivots around that very sore issue, and all kinds of issues grow out of that, issues of class, issues of responsibility, issues of what we owe to the next generation, and really how much difference can we make if they have sort of different struggles than Max Sr., the father, does.
And also sexuality as well.
Absolutely, sexuality, yes.
These themes of parents and children, at one point you did say that one of the reasons you wanted to write the book is you wanted to see about the choices that fathers make, in particular whether to keep Claire, the daughter, or give her away essentially to somebody who might be able to raise her, and that this occurs frequently in orphanages in Haiti, where you've got people with parents going to orphanages, which is what happened in America during the Depression.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm glad you made that connection, because I think sometimes people forget that we're dealing with very human issues that others have faced before and that keep reoccurring because we're trying to all achieve really the same goals. The Cuban parents who sent their children ahead and there's Peter Pan, that situation, were thinking they were doing the best for their children. And sometimes parents are in a situation where they would give their lives for their children, and they feel like this is, you know, this separation, this choice, I think, in a way, is an extra level of love, because it's a love that is being severely tested. Do I keep my child with me, or do I send my child ahead and one of us makes it? And I think ultimately, in these dire situations of survival, that's the choice that whether the parents in the Depression or the parents in Haiti or the parents in Cuba were facing.
But, of course, from the child's perspective, the idea of the parent walking is rejection no matter what the circumstances. I mean, I can't imagine Claire being in any way pleased about, say, her father's choice. And this is not giving anything away. The choice is made at the very beginning of the book that he will do that, and he'll give her to the right person, but it's still rejection.
Yeah. He'll give her to who he thinks is the right person, but it's as right as he could possibly get if that works out. But to the child, you're absolutely right. It is still looking at your parents' back walking away, no matter what the reason is. And I think as a parent, it's so incredibly hard for me to imagine that, having to make that choice. And it gives me so much empathy for my parents, because they had to leave Haiti and move to the United States when we were very young. So I think it's a Faustian bargain. It's a horrible choice, which seems probably even more unbearable from the perspective of the child, to whom no explanation would make sense, because all the child wants is to be with his or her mother, or his or her father, yeah, in Claire's case. So I think it's something that's very hard to explain.
Right now you have an 8-year-old and a 4-year-old, and I keep thinking maybe you were pregnant when I saw you. I don't remember.
I had a 2-year-old, yeah, and I was very new to parenting, and part of the book was her birth, because my daughter Mira was, who was named after my father, and she was born a month after he died. So I was just new to parenting, parenthood, and this is actually my first fiction since becoming a mom, and I think a lot of my fears and sort of my anxieties about kind of the worst case scenarios go into that. And I also think there's a kind of circularity to just revisiting my childhood and linking what it was like to miss my parents with imagining what it might be like for my children to miss me.
Or, of course, in the case of Madame Gale, the fabric vendor losing a daughter.
And it's unimaginable when you're a parent. And after my oldest was born, it was very hard for me to read fiction in which children were in distress. And often people would ask, well, then, why is it possible to write about a situation where children are in distress? I mean, not physical distress, some physical distress. But I think part of it is because in one case we can change it. Someone was saying to me, it's like when you're making a film, you can see how the explosion is done, so you know it's not real. But when you're watching a movie, you're not sure.
Edwidge Danticat, this brings up an interesting point, though, which is a curious thing about fiction itself, which I'd like you to talk about, which is that the more particular you make a story, for some reason, the more universal that story becomes. Do you know what I mean?
That whole notion of universality is not something we can reach for. You know, we can't sit around and say, I'm going to write the most universal story, because then it's stretched thin, then, you know, and what is that story anyway? As a reader, you know, even before considering the, you know, being a writer part of it, but as a reader, I can feel it when someone has written something that means a great deal to them, that has incited passion in them, that they wrestled with. I think those particular stories, they touch people, like, in a way that, because of the specificity of it, because you're invited to inhabit a world. You know, Toni Morrison often, she says, Dostoevsky probably didn't think he was writing for a little black girl in Lorain, Ohio, when he was writing those books. He probably never did know about Lorain, Ohio exist, but he was able to write something that was so specific to his place and time, yet could speak to a little girl in Lorain, Ohio, who could then grow up to write extraordinary novels that then could speak to little Russian girls now. I mean, I think that the beauty of any kind of artistic creation, and that, you know, if you pay attention to your individual postage stamp of the world, that it might invite others to as well.
You said in an interview that when you were much younger in your early writing, things seemed more black and white than they do today. And I kept thinking about the character of Max Jr. in particular, who does a terrible thing, and yet at the same time he's a sympathetic character, as is Madame Gale, as is Louise George, in that there's shades of gray in everybody. Do you think that this is a case of growing older, or do you think you were writing those kind of characters then?
You know, it's kind of thorny, if you will, because I think some people expect their evil characters to be punished more severely than I have punished some of mine. But I think there's shades of gray and human nature, right, in that, you know, you have the case of sometimes these torturers, I wrote about one in a book called The Dewbreaker. And so you have this person who goes and tortures people and all day and goes home and has dinner and plays with his kids, and people are able to compartmentalize these parts of themselves. And so I don't think it's something that should be rewarded, but I think it's something that should be understood, because it's so often replicated. So as a fiction writer, I feel like I owe the same obligation to my so-called good characters as I do to my bad ones. And the bad ones even more so, because people have to understand why they're bad, you know.
Well, what happens when you, I mean, you haven't done this in this book, but if you came across an ex-Totonmakut, I mean, how do you deal with something like someone so horrible who did so many horrible things?
I have, over and over. One of the reasons that when I started writing The Dewbreaker was that I would often find myself in rooms with people like that, with other Haitians, and some of whom would just whisper, and they would say, "That's so and so," and that would be someone who is a sort of a big makout, and I would be shocked that people weren't throwing drinks. There was no slapping of faces. There was just that whisper and the acknowledgement that there was sort of this evil among us. The restraint, I thought, was incredible. And people who had lost family members, and even to this day, like, you could have the former dictator walk into restaurants and people just stare, and big-time restaurants in Haiti. So I wanted to explore those shades of gray. And I think as you get older, and also you meet different kinds of people, and the craft requires it, frankly, for you to see all that. If you want to do three-dimensional characters, if you don't just want to paint like wings or devil's horns on characters, you have to dig deeper into sort of what made them, what created them, how did they become the people they are. And often in that quest, there's some sympathetic elements. I once met a man who had read The Dewbreaker, and he came up to me at an event, and he said, "You know, I was one of those people." And now he had he was running a mission in Haiti. He was a Christian and was doing all these good things. He said, I was one of those people, but I had no choice. He said, I would have been dead if I had walked away at any moment. And he was very sorry, but I felt like this was the embodiment of that too, that you have to hope. I mean, at least there has to be some hope that at least in some cases, in that particular case, this man had come to see the errors of his ways. Now, the problematic in real life part is that a lot of them don't. A lot of them are unrepentant and don't regret a single thing.
Edwige Danticat, let's change the subject. You were an actress in three movies, Stones in the Sun, The Manchurian Candidate, and Beloved. How did those things happen?
You've got me. I used to work for Jonathan Demme, wonderful filmmaker, Silence of the Lambs and other films. So when I graduated from graduate school, that was my first job out of school. I was an assistant to Jonathan Demme, and actually many of my early trips to Haiti were with him. We worked on documentaries and one including The Agronomist, which was about Jean-Dominique, one of Haiti's most famous radio journalists. We work on a film called Courage and Pain about Haitian torture survivors. And so Beloved was filmed when I was working for him, and I was an extra in Beloved. But in The Manchurian Candidate, I am mentioned, but I'm not in it. But Stones in the Sun is a film that was directed by a very good friend of mine, my very best friend, a woman named Patricia Benoit, who's Haitian-American. It's about some of the things that we had been talking about, people who have to leave Haiti during what she calls the time of the generals. So it was sort of right after the dictatorship has ended in 1986. There hasn't yet been an election. The first democratically elected president was in 1990, so it's in that gap. There was still sort of the post-dictatorship oppression. So the story is about a group of people who then have to come to New York. I play a college professor who is an activist who has to move in with her sister, who is sort of a vain real estate agent who has embraced the American dream and is not looking back. And now this sort of estranged activist professor sister lands on her doorstep. And there's also the story of a young woman who was raped, and then she has to rejoin her husband in New York. But one of the central stories is a father and son story about the father who was a dew breaker. He was a big tonton makout, and his son is an activist in radio in New York City, and they have to. So it's sort of bringing together all these halves of different families, and I was really happy to do it. But you know what they say about amateur actors, which I am, is you get one that can play someone like herself. And I'd like to think that I'm like that woman. But it was a wonderful experience.
Has it been released?
It hasn't had wide release. It was first shown at the Tribeca Film Festival, where it won an award, and so it's been doing the festival rounds.
And may eventually be released, or if nothing else, you'll be able to see it via Netflix, I guess, at some point.
Ultimately, we hope, yeah.
Edwige Danticat, two questions. First, have you been back to Haiti recently, and how are things doing a couple of years after the quake?
Oh, I was back in July, a couple of years after the quake. I mean, it's been slow going. I think I would recommend to everybody who is able to see it a film by Raoul Peck called Fatal Assistance, where he really frames that whole issue of the post-earthquake aid and sort of the political interference that leads us to this moment today. Because people are always saying, you know, where did my $20 go a couple of years after the earthquake? And that film answers it, that a lot of it was unfortunately squandered, a lot of it was, returned to the country where they were donated. Some of it was spent on fancy SUVs for NGO people, but the film makes a very powerful case for sort of what happens post-disaster in Haiti, certainly, as we near the fourth anniversary of the quake, but also what seems to be like a pattern in post-disasters in many different places.
And the name of the film again?
It's called Fatal Assistance. It will hopefully have a cinematic release soon, and I'm sure it will come to the Bay Area and other places.
And finally, what are you working on now?
I'm currently working on a young adult novel about twin sisters. I always try to have something going while I'm doing this part of, you know, sort of the postpartum of a book. For a lot of writers, by the time we're talking to you, having this wonderful conversation, the book has been away from us for about a year or so. So I got that advice early on to, before you go on book tour, start something. And I've started writing this story that I was meant to start earlier, and I'm having a really good time writing about twins.
You've been listening to an interview with Edwige Danticat, whose latest novel is Claire of the Sea Light. I'm Richard Walensky on Book Waves.